If you're enjoying these episodes of Yankton's Yardbirds, join us on our support site called buymeacoffee.com. Please consider clicking the Support the Show link included in the description of each show. You can choose to donate $5, $10, $15, or $20, or you can become a member. Members will receive extra content that will be added as the shows progress. This will include pictures of the vets, audio interviews, maps, write-ups, and much more content that will be available to members only. Please consider making a donation or becoming a member soon. And as always, thank you for listening to Yankton's Yardbirds. Today's podcast is sponsored by David M. Hosmer Law Office, which is celebrating David's 30th year practicing law. You may not need a lawyer, but when you do, you need an excellent one. Contact him at davidhosmer@hotmail.com.
Welcome to Yankton's Yardbirds, a podcast presenting the World War II stories of Yankton's veterans. After 165 interviews and countless hours of preparation, it's time to share these stories. As of now, they'll be shared by podcast and later will be presented in print. If you have questions, feel free to contact me at davidhosmer@hotmail.com. Please be advised that there is some offensive language within these interviews. When I'm speaking, I've edited my language to more modern times. It's going to be said a thousand times hereafter, but Warren Jorgensen, who was injured and hobble running back to Malinta Tunnel, was likely thinking to himself, "How the hell did I get here?" Born in Bertram, Iowa, to George Rudolph and Bertha Riefen Jorgensen on the 15th of March, 1921, his paternal grandparents were immigrants from Norway and his maternal grandparents were immigrants from Germany. Warren had three sisters. He loved Bertram, an old railroad town, for its spacious areas where he could roam. His childhood job was delivering newspapers. Even though his father kept his job during the Depression, it was difficult. This is a family that valued education, demonstrated by the fact that he attended Cedar Rapids High School and rode the train back and forth each weekend while living in a boarding house during the week. As a youngster, he emulated his father and wanted to be a train engineer. His father discouraged him, however, because the wages were low and there was no room for promotion. After he graduated from high school in 1939, he worked some tough jobs, a rock crusher at a stone quarry, and then a laborer at a feed mill. His life nearly ended when he developed appendicitis. Rather than have the operation, he drank black coffee, which appears to be a home remedy not advised by the medical profession. Nevertheless, he recovered, but he couldn't perform any heavy labor. Warren searched the newspaper for something else to do and came across an ad for the Marine Corps. It was exciting to think of faraway places. It sounds romantic. So he applied in Cedar Rapids, and he was accepted. There was one issue. He was dating Ruth Harrison, and he hadn't told her. In fact, they went to the movies the night before he boarded the train. When he finally told her, she was distraught that he enlisted. There was a mutual understanding that they would wait for each other, and they frequently penned letters to the other. Back in Bataan, Warren wobbled into Malinta Tunnel. Officers stood around and implored privates to look for Japs! The smell of gangrene, burned flesh, and ether burned Warren's nose. Men from the destroyed Geary battery were in the hospital located deep inside the tunnel, and the smells from the hospital wafted in and around the tunnel wings. The hospital was a mess. It was bedlam. He made his way to the surgeon's assistant, who told him that the wounds were not serious enough to warrant him staying. Warren did not feel well from the loss of blood. He walked toward the front of the tunnel, fell into a bunk to snatch a few minutes of needed rest. The Corregidor defenders valiantly battled for nearly 10 hours. 800 defenders died compared to 900 Japanese, but the result was inevitable. In anticipation of the arrival of the tanks, the Japanese began an artillery barrage which pushed the Marine skirmish line back another 600 yards. The Japanese witnessed the retreat and poured on even more artillery. Very few men made it back to Malinta Tunnel. The three Japanese tanks made their way westward, and the Americans had no anti-tank weapons. Nearly 1,000 men were already in the hospital as Warren dozed restlessly near the entrance. He woke to the words from a loudspeaker, quote, "The Japanese have conquered. Wainwright has surrendered. The Japanese will be approaching the tunnel in very short time. There will be no fighting, unquote. He looked around and he was soaked in his own blood. I was awake when the tank came into the opening of the tunnel. I heard the noisy clanking. And then a Japanese soldier told him he was a prisoner and instructed everyone to lift their hands. He fell asleep again, and this time he didn't stir. When he awoke next, he was in the hospital. After his surgery to repair the bullet hole, he woke up and was laying beneath white sheets. He was a prisoner, but he was alive. At 1:30 p.m. on the 6th of May, Wainwright, as a condition imposed by the Japanese, surrendered all of the remaining American forces in the Philippines. The 4th Marines had already burned the regimental and United States flags to avoid capture. The Corregidor survivors escaped the death march, but untold hells would ensue. Looking back, MacArthur described those soldiers who fought in Bataan and Corregidor. Their, quote, long protracted struggle enabled the Allies to gain strength. Had it not held out, Australia would have fallen with incalculably disastrous results. Our triumphs today at Corregidor in February of 1945 belong equally to that dead army from 1942. South of Corregidor was the island of Mindanao, where Americans were still on the run. Life there was tough. According to Bob Phillips, I only had 2 meals per day between December and April. It was there, quote, that I saw my first Jap soldier on the 10th of May. They had landed, and they were right on our tails, untrained as we were. The sun went down on the 9th of May. I went to sleep. I had been stationed to guard a trail that went to a ravine. We had spent a week on the run and came out in a village, Sumalaw, in the Bukidnon province. When I lay down, I realized that I was going to get killed. The ravine was just crawling with Japs who had just flanked us. We had no place to go anyway. It would have been difficult to stay on the run. Filipinos blended in the population, but we couldn't. We laid down our arms, but I wrapped my Springfield rifle around a palm tree prior to being taken. Phillips credits Wainwright's complete surrender for his survival. Wainwright surrendered on the 6th, but it was not immediately accepted by the Japanese. 4 days later, the Japanese agreed because all Americans on all islands had to surrender. He was in the village of Sumalaw, where 40 or 50 Americans stacked their arms and were permitted to live. Phillips was taken to Camp Kaesong, a Filipino camp composed of native huts near the Malabalay. Bob was put on work detail planting kamots, something akin to a sweet potato. Every man was put into a group of 10 and told, quote, if any of you attempt to escape, all of the 9 men will be killed. Several Filipino soldiers were captured and shot to death in plain sight of our chow line, as if to emphasize that we too would suffer that end if we escaped. That point was made clearly, unquote. He was there until the 1st of October 1942, when an intercoastal ferry, the Ama Mara, took him to the infamous Bilibid prison in Manila. At about that time, 12,000 Corregidor prisoners assembled on the concrete apron of the seaplane hangar, known as the 92nd Garage. Americans were separated from the Filipinos. The prisoners picked up the dead, which were burned. 12 days later, the prisoners were taken to Manila, but not Warren. There are still men missing. Their bodies were never found. One person who simply disappeared without any trace is Sergeant Andrew William Zog from Scotland, South Dakota. When Warren Jorgensen said that the dead bodies were burned on Corregidor, this immediately brought Andrew to mind. Born on the 28th of October 1916 in Loveland, Colorado, to the Reverend Ulrich and Elizabeth Herbster Zog, Andrew had 9 siblings. Reverend Ulrich emigrated from Graz, Switzerland, and worked at the Reformed Church in Scotland, South Dakota. According to his family, Andrew loved swimming, ice skating, skiing, and classical music. He could walk down from the upstairs to the first floor by walking on his hands. Scotland High School was his alma mater. Andy worked in the CCC in Minnesota and later worked in a lumberyard. And he enlisted in the Army, suggested his brother, because he liked the orderliness of the military. The Army assigned him to the headquarters of General George Grunert, the department commander of the Philippines. Zog's family did not hear from Andrew after December 7th. According to Marine records, Army men from the headquarters company who arrived at Corregidor were placed into reserve known as the 4th of the 4th. They bivouacked at Government Ravine located to the southwest of Geary Battery and were led by Marine Captain Francis Hubert Williams. The 250 men were divided between companies O and P. Some men in reserve were called into action after the explosions of both Geary and Crockett batteries. Under dangerous conditions, if Andy was one of the men who rushed to help, he would have seen gruesome images. On the 3rd of May, the submarine USS Spearfish arrived to rescue a few lucky personnel and they were also presented with a complete list of all military personnel remaining on Corregidor. Andrew's name was not on that list. The War Department presumed that Andrew died in 1942, and the family held a memorial service in 1946, but his family never gave up. According to Andrew's last remaining sibling, after the war, it was common to place advertisements in military publications such as the VFW Monthly magazine, asking for help. The family paid for such an ad and wanted to know if anyone remembered Andrew. The limited information they received suggested that he made his way from Manila to Corregidor, where he died. His name is etched into the tablets of the Missing in Manila American Cemetery Memorial. When Andrew did not return home, his younger brother used Andrew's old Hupmobile. His final thought about Andy was that, quote, he was a good person, unquote. Jorgensen did not travel to Manila due to his injuries. After he awoke, he saw his wounds covered with gauze, but he didn't see any Japanese soldiers, only well-respected nurses there to care for him. These women would later be known as the Angels of Corregidor and Bataan. Warren walked around the ward and saw a couple of people he knew. One was a friend who admitted that he'd shot himself, and he sobbed uncontrollably. Even at the east entrance of the tunnel, Japanese soldiers paid no attention to him. He suspected that they were lax on safety because the Japanese found some of their own injured amongst the Americans in the hospital. Warren was put on a work duty a few weeks later. I stayed on topside for a year, he said. Meanwhile, in Aguilar, Filipinos experienced the rough hand of Japanese occupation. Japanese soldiers searched the Sawi residence for prohibited items such as weapons and radios. Mom had already surrendered my dad's pistol, according to Nick. Possessing a weapon would bring swift and severe punishment, including death. No one in his family was harmed by the Japanese, but they certainly saw it happen to others. Anyone suspected of helping the underground guerrillas, Filipino civilians, and military who refused to comply with the occupation was physically abused and taken away. They were never seen again, said Sawi. He cannot erase the memories of these terrible times. As the Japanese were about to seize Manila, the Philippine government had decided to dump silver pesos in the Manila Bay. After burning millions of dollars of currency and placing several million dollars of gold bullion and silver aboard the submarine USS Trout, the Americans removed the 17 million silver pesos from a Corregidor vault and dropped them into the nearby Caballo Bay. Several of those silver coins were recovered off the coast of Corregidor. To this day, Nick carries a silver coin to keep his birth country and his loved ones in his thoughts. The dumped coin story must have been common, because Warren mentioned it too. The Japanese asked the American prisoners in Corregidor if any had diving experience. The Navy men in charge came from the Canopus, which is likely source of Warren's reliable information. It was difficult work. The silver coins weighed 425 tons. According to Jorgensen, quote, these guys told us that the Japs didn't get all the silver coins, unquote. Evidently, one of the American divers who was compelled to dive for the silver pesos wrote a book. The story is found in Robert Sheet's book, One Man's War, Diving as a Guest of the Emperor. In 1943, Jorgensen was taken to Manila's Bilibid prison. Every prisoner who came through Manila spent time there. He was then moved to Clark Field, where he helped repair runways. He personally experienced Japanese brutality there. The Japanese chief officer was nicknamed Saber Happy. Warren's work detail encountered 4 to 5 Filipinos walking in single file from the galley to the garbage pit. They passed between us, and I grabbed a piece of liver. I just stuck it in my raincoat. The Japs saw us. When they got to the kitchen, Saber Happy lined all 10 of us up in the shed. I was the third man from the end. He hit the first two guys, and he must have hurt his hand because he was infuriated. He then came back and changed hands. When he hit me on the cheek, I felt like I was going down, but I caught myself. I came back up on my feet. My jaw really hurt. An x-ray many years later showed a funny spot on his cheek. He fractured my cheekbone and dislocated my jaw. The doctor tried to put it back in. One day, I was eating and it just popped back into place. After he was released, Warren attended Drake University. Before I got to college, I struck up a relationship with an A&R man. The A&R men signed talent to record labels. They took on a lot of Westerns. I wrote the copy. After I graduated in 1951, I worked for Capitol Records and later Musicland. You previously learned of Warren's girlfriend, who said she would wait for his return from the military. Warren has written a wonderful book, The Expendable Garrison, about her and his military life. And you'll have to read that to find out what happened next. The tragedies in the Philippines were worse than Pearl Harbor by one measure. The sneak attack at Pearl Harbor was shocking because so many men died in such a short time. However, the number of dead casualties and prisoners in the Philippines was far greater because the Bataan Corregidor defenders diligently kept the Japanese occupied for nearly a half year, and there were just so many of them. By June of 1942, the horrors of war slid into an incarceration hellhole due to sadistic Japanese soldiers. Straka and thousands of others experienced the Bataan death march, the terror trains, and the death camps. This was a low moment for America, although news of this savagery would not leak out for many, many more months. The families were desperate and formed an association, later reformed as the American Defenders of Bataan and Corregidor. The death rate of prisoners in the hands of Japanese was 1 in 3, while that of the prisoners in American hands was just 0.15%. Again, by way of comparison, the Japanese killed American prisoners while the Americans paid German and Italian prisoners for their labor. We've come to the end of the First Battle of the Philippines, and we'll return back to the Philippines again in 1944. But our next podcast will take us to the homeland and to Australia, where the Americans, including the lucky 147th, regrouped after Pearl Harbor and Bataan in an attempt to stop the Japanese at the Malay Barrier.
If you are interested in sponsoring an episode of Yankton's Yardbirds, please contact David Hosmer at davidhosmer@hotmail.com. All content for this podcast was created by David Hosmer, and all production was performed by Eric Berenger. Thank you for listening to this episode of Yankton's Yardbirds.